The song that launched Alice Cooper onto an unsuspecting world. Alice Cooper in the 70s is the new book by Chris Sutton. The 70s saw the arrival of Alice Cooper as a major force in the rock firmament. Chris explores the story of Alice Cooper, the band, and also Alice the song performer from the early years through to the end of the decade. It was a roller coaster. Delighted to be joining me from somewhere in the UK. Author of Alice Cooper in the 1970s, Chris Sutton. Chris, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good to have you with us. Whereabouts in the UK are you, by the way?
Well, we moved from Birmingham to Great Malvern, which is in Worcestershire. Some of your listeners will undoubtedly know where I am. So
it's a very nice part of the world indeed.
It is, yeah, just in the shadow of the hills. And that record you played there, Schools Out, that was absolutely where it all started for me with Alice Cooper. Some of your listeners will know this, but back in the day, Top of the Pops was the biggest thing on a Thursday night. And we were on holiday at the time, mum, dad and family. And the only way you could actually watch this was to go into a TV room at the Butlins camp where we were, sit through Tomorrow's World. You had to sit all through that to get your seat.
Yep.
And that was the first time I'd ever seen Alice Cooper, actually seen the band. And it was just an absolutely mind-blowing moment.
Let me ask the question, which Butlins camp did this epiphany take place at?
You're ready for this then. It was called Minehead then. It's now Somerset World or something like that.
Okay. Minehead. So was it really that moment you had never seen anything about it? And you're probably around my age, so you would have been about, let's think, 73. You would have been about sort of six or seven around that time, maybe a little bit younger. Okay, maybe
a
not.
A bit older.
Okay, fair
a
enough.
A bit older.
Then. Luckily, through clean living and regular prayer, you obviously...
I was a crucial 10 and a half. Oh. A half is crucial. 10 and a half.
So did you rush back and say, Mum, Dad, I wish to put face paint on, get a python and basically faff around in glam boots the rest of my life?
I'll tell you what it was the record was all over the radio. And then for that week in Butlins, there were all the bars and all around the sites, and that record kept coming out on the jukeboxes everywhere. And when he was on in that TV room, all the old people were going, what's this dreadful, you know, what's this? And all the young people were going, that's it. That's for us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just like, it was like the punk thing years later.
Isn't it, though? It's interesting that a song can connect with people. It's 1972, that one, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So isn't it funny how a song could connect and then basically and just take off and be the song of the summer? I mean, I remember that song being, I think it was probably banned from my school being played because it would incite riots, basically.
That's quite true. It was thought to be, it is almost a pre-punk record. Glenn Buxton's opening riff is that searing guitar riff. It's just something else. And then you get that bolero section on the chorus when they go into that bolero beat for the Schools Out for summer. It's just classic stuff.
I mean, at a time when, you know, we had heavy rock had been around for about two years since Sabbath stroke Purple or whatever. But you've got that sort of, it's just before glam. It's a little bit lost, isn't it? It's got a bit sort of self-referential to some points, and the glam thing is a bit meat-headed for some people, or a bit too much frippery, shall we say, on a Friday. Alice Cooper, an incredibly intelligent guy, and he knew, and with some great musicians. It's not just Alice on his own, of course, but that original incarnation of the Alice Cooper band is quite something.
I think it's crucial, the point you make there. Alice Cooper was a band, and a lot of people still don't get that. Vince Furnier, who was a singer, adopted the persona of Alice Cooper because it was easier to push a person than the band. But all those hits that your listeners will know, the older listeners anyway, all the way through, No One Missed a Nice Guy, Elected, Under My Wheels, 18, Schools End, all the way through to mid-74, Alice Cooper was a band. And the guys in the band, luckily I talked to all three of the other members of the band who are still alive, Dennis Dunaway, Neil Smith, and Michael Bruce. And let me tell you, you're a journalist, you'll know this, but when you ring up somebody who's been a hero of yours since you were 10 and they answer the phone, that is a moment.
Isn't it? And don't you just suddenly go, oh, you know, isn't it? And then they say, like, Dennis here, you know, it is quite something.
Well, with respect, what had happened was the first one I got was Neil Smith, the drummer. And most of these guys tend to go through their stories that they do. And you're going to get those stories anyway. But I'd contacted Neil and said, if we speak, there's about 10 things I'll ask you that nobody else ever has because I've never seen them answered. And I told him what they were. he went away and came back and said, yeah, okay, let's do this, let's do this. And we had a great chat. And it was Neil who got me Michael Bruce and then got me Dennis Dunaway because he'd enjoyed the chat.
Yeah.
He opened the door for me.
Word of mouth is always a good one. One of the things that I interviewed Dennis a couple of years ago for his autobiography, and it's a fabulous book. And one of the things that struck me was, you know, this, they didn't just muck. I mean, the thing with Alice Cooper, A, it's a band, it's not one person. And B, you know, there was very little satanic bloodletting going on, despite what you might have heard from later things. I mean, that was a whole sort of Wayne's World thing. They were an incredibly hard-working band. I mean, I remember reading about, you know, Alice taking them off to a barn to somewhere in the middle of the countryside and getting those albums ready.
They worked really hard, and the philosophy was, no matter what the publicity was, any publicity was good publicity. It didn't matter what it was, they would agree to it. Alice is known to make up a lot of stories that, should we say, are sketchy on the truth, perhaps at times. And so getting to the bottom of some of those stories was interesting. And then in his solo career, because as you said earlier to the listeners, I do the albums up to 79, his solo years. Most of those musicians, a lot of them, had never talked about their time with Alice or what they'd done. Alan Schwarzberg, the drummer, John Trapeo on guitar, Prakash John bass, never really spoken at all about what they did.
I mean, why do you think that Alice Cooper, has been a success, I mean, through the years? I mean, here we are in 2021. Okay, nobody's touring at the moment. Mm. But, I mean, and this shows how time plays mean tricks on you. But you think, oh, yeah, as recent as Wayne's World, and then you find out that Wayne's World was sort of 29 years ago. But he's been a, you know, he's got a fan base. And this is the thing about rock bands on the heavier spectrum. If you get them as a fan, there is no more loyal fan, and I spoke to Susie Quatcher about this as well, than a rock fan who really has been with you since the start.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think with the Cooper Group, it was originality, the jazz influences, the rock, the blues influences that came in. And he has kept that loyal fan base, all those bands. And I do like the likes of Zeppelin, Sabbath, Yes as well. They all have kept that fan base. And then there's times when new fans come in with Alice. The next biggest was undoubtedly with the Trash album and Poison. He got a whole new fan base came in for that. They weren't really aware of what happened before. And the answer to the next question is yes, there is a plan already for Alice in the 80s.
Yeah, because that's an
interesting... That's kind of coming.
That's an interesting period as well, both professionally and personally with him, isn't it? I mean, it really is. And also, because it's very easy to say, okay, well, you know, school's out, everybody knows that, the album. So rock and roll is littered with bands who've had brilliant first albums, because that's everything they've done to this point. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to go and record another one. And the great thing about Alice Cooper is that they came out with albums like Billion Dollar Babies, for example, which, you know, again, huge seller. I mean, rocking up the sales again.
Yeah, Billion Dollar Babies was number one in Britain and America at the same time. That hadn't really happened very much. Rod Stewart did it with one of his albums as well. But there are something like four hit singles on that album. It's just an absolute masterpiece. I think that's the peak for the original band, the Cooper Group. It's probably Billion Dollar Babies for me, that album.
So what, I mean, what... When you come to write about this and to document it, then, I mean, what approach were you going to do it? Sort of song by song? Were you going to do it, album by album? Were you going to take timelines? And how much do you separate, if you like, the musician and the musicianship from the notoriety and the shenanigans, shall we call it?
Well, there was a couple of aspects to that. One, the publisher, Sonic Bond Publishing, Stephen Lamb, was very kind, and I explained to him that I wanted to do something a bit different to some of the other books that I'd seen and read. And I told him I could probably get a lot of people to talk to me because they're people I've kind of known of and were aware of. And I was arrogantly confident that I could get them to do this, which they did. So, but it's hard to put yourself, I realised I've actually got to put my whole passion and enthusiasm into writing about the songs and get that across, get the musician's perspective across, and give a timeline of the period of what was going on for Alice in and around each of the albums. So it was a combination of all those things. So it was a bit of a juggling act at times to get the balance right.
I was going to say, you gave yourself a bit of a task there. It would have been easy just to do a discography and said he wrote this one, he wrote that one. This is, you know, basically no. Just nick the liner notes.
No, I'll tell you the inspiration. I hadn't told Stephen Lamb this. So there's a brilliant book by a guy called Ian MacDonald, Revolution in the Head, about the Beatles.
Right.
And you read that book, and anybody who reads that book, you would just want to go away and put the Beatles on and listen to the songs. And that's what I wanted to get to, was in my own way, I can't be as good as Ian McDonald. But to the point where you go, hey, I think I'm going to go and listen to that song again. I didn't hear that bit. I didn't know that. Or there's a bit on a song called Go to Hell, which you may know, by Alice Cooper. And just in passing, John Trappay, who plays guitar, and it says, hey, I'll tell you a story. You know that bit at the beginning where there's that noise, those noise effects going on? I said, yeah. I've always wondered what that is. And he said the percussionist had a tray of percussion, a guy called Jimmy Malin, and he would just drop them on the floor. And then if he didn't like it, they'd have to redo the take. But it meant the whole band had to go and pick all the bits up, put them back on the tray so we could drop it again. And this is pre-sampling. That's what they had to do in those days. And it was that little bit of insight and those quirks. I love hearing those stories from these guys. And I'd count many of them as being friends now. We keep in touch since the book. It's lovely.
Oh, absolutely brilliant. So, again, I mean, how much of... Because nothing exists in a vacuum, and that's what I learned from science.
No.
But nothing exists in a vacuum. So and my science teacher will be sagely nodding his head wherever he is. What was the background to the Alice Cooper songs and to their success in the 70s? Because they do, and if you like, they form a bridge, don't they, from that heavy through glam through to, you know, West Coast rock that hits, you know, California rock that hits in 79 with Van Halen, for example.
Yeah, they did. The first big song for them was not so much over in Britain, and certainly not in Spain, was I'm 18, which was a huge breakout hit for them in the end of 1970 when they hooked up with a guy called Bob Ezrin, who became their producer. And he honed their sound and made it more commercialized it a bit, made it more palatable for a mass audience. And I'm 18 was the example. It was like My Generation or something for The Who. That kind of a song. It was such a big instant hit. So all of their singles, when you listen to them, are kind of these anthemic songs like Elected, School's Out, Hello Hooray. And then the albums, you got all these things where the other band members would put stuff in that was a bit different, a bit challenging maybe at times. There's a track which I doubt you could play on there because the listeners would probably go away for a while, but Halo of Flies is everything. That is the best Alice Cooper band track for me, Halo of Flies.
Right, okay, because it's got everything.
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 It's a cinematic journey across the world. It's like a spy movie brought to life. The band have just got killer chops on it. It's got the first bass drum solo in the middle of it. Moog synthesizer.
Oh, the Moog.
Everything. Everything.
Sounds like everything that the punks were rebelling against, isn't it, really? What? Alice Cooper live. What's the experience like, and what, you know, because a lot of these bands, obviously, again, it's pre by about a couple of thousand decades, it's pre social media, it's pre YouTube. You've got to go, you know, a band put a single out and then go on tour to promote that single or that album.
They did. I mean, just to go back a little bit, the punks, Johnny Rotten actually did his audition for the Sex Pistols miming to I'm 18 in the jukebox in Malcolm McLaren's shop.
Right.
And Johnny Rotten's favourite album of all time is Killer by the Alice Cooper Group. His second favourite album was the one before it, Love It to Death.
Okay.
So they could see what was there.
Yeah, let's just stop there. Because, I mean, okay, so you've got Cooper, you've got Alice Cooper, you've got the band, you've got their look, you know, which is, so, you know, it's the makeup, but it's not makeup done like spiders were doing makeup, which is making them all look pretty or sweet, or there were some real knuckle draggers wearing mascara during the glam rock period. Sorry, sweet. They wearing makeup as a sort of thing that you would see coming out in New Orleans in one of the, you know, wouldn't you?
The Coopers were all about, this is what it's like now in America with Watergate and that kind of thing. And they were of the time. They were taking the glam rock thing, and as you're saying, pulling it apart a bit and doing things differently. And Alice has always said, and he would if he was talking to you now, the punks, Johnny Rotten and so on, they were just doing then what he'd done, just doing it differently of that time, and still goes on to this day. Live, the Cooper Group were, they got banned in some places, and they tried to ban them in Britain in 1973. In fact, the band had no intention of coming to Britain in 73, but they didn't let that get in the way of a good story. So, yeah, and of course you're talking about the guillotine on stage and the hanging and the kind of things that they did. And this was shocking. But as Alice would say, Groucho Marx, who was a friend of Alice's, he got this. He said, he looked at their show and said, well, it's vaudeville, isn't it? It's just vaudeville for the 1970s. It's what it always is. It's just off its time.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's that idea, isn't it, of putting on a show, and it is that almost Victoriana sort of horror and look behind you and you know, the thing with the guillotines and that, you know, the dark rock, you know, don't let your daughters go and see it. So obviously the kids can't wait to get to see it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the other big incident, do you know about the chicken incident?
Tell me, well, I mean, we've got presumably are we into Aussie territory and biting off of heads here, or is it something even more, or is it guillotining a chicken?
No, we're not going to offend anyone. What it was they were playing a big festival in Toronto, and somehow a chicken appeared on stage.
Oh, Toronto's known for its loose fowl. They've got really bad poultry control up there.
Well, nobody's admitting to it, but the sharp money is that somebody in the band's entourage put a chicken on stage for some reason. Alice has always said he didn't know that chickens can't fly.
Right.
He thought they flew.
Yeah.
So he picks up the chicken. This is on video, so it's true. And he threw it into the audience. Yeah. And it kind of went up and down. And the front row, and this is the bad bit, listeners, they actually pulled it apart, destroyed the chicken. I know it's grim.
Right.
The band absolutely got, you know, a complete storm from, you know, the place went quiet. The whole auditorium went absolutely quiet. And the band thought they'd blown it. And then the press the next day was so colossal, riding across the country what this incident was. And they thought, you know, as I said to you earlier, bad press is as good as good press. There is no bad press, was the view. It doesn't matter what it is. You probably know the one about when they stopped the truck in the middle of Piccadilly Circus. You know that one in 72?
Please refresh my grey matter and those new listeners who may not know about the Piccadilly Circus incident.
Well, what do you do when you're trying to sell out a big concert in London and the tickets have been a bit slow for whatever reason? What you do is you put a big billboard of a naked Alice Cooper with a snake wrapped around him over the important parts. You tell the driver that no matter what happens, he's going to stop that truck in Piccadilly Circus in the rush hour and he's not going to move it no matter what happens.
And this is 1970s Piccadilly Circus, of course, which was
1972,
which is a busy, you know, thoroughfare as opposed to the sort of like the tourist area it is now. I think the last time it was all pedestrianised more or less.
That's right. Yeah, it was when it was busy. Because this is in 72 before the gig at Wembley. Of course, then what you do is you alert the TV and all the press that there's likely to possibly be an incident in Piccadilly Circus. They all turn up. The police are everywhere. The cameras are there. It's on the news. The truck driver gets hauled off and fined. The band, I think the management actually paid his fine. They paid him enough money to pay off his mortgage.
Right, fair enough.
Job done. TV, press, gig sold out.
And of course, you see, the thing is, you know, we're talking about that and people might go, oh, well, so what? You know, when you turn on, you know, CBTVs and there's a half-naked rapper somewhere. But at that point, you know, Alice, a naked man with a large python, pardon the expression, ladies, you know, in front on a billboard was absolutely the fall of Western civilization as we knew it.
Absolutely right. That was then. I mean, Alice himself and the band would fully appreciate that now people would be going, oh, so what? So what? But back then he was a big deal. Now you've got to really raise your game to upset people. That's true.
So how did you go about then? I mean, how do you, you know, we talked about getting, you know, putting it together rather than just by discography, but it must be a great excuse to go through all the back catalogue and read up the you know, the reports that are coming out and really sort of like submerge yourself in total Alice Cooper for a couple of months.
Well, yeah, it was longer than a couple of months because it was during the lockdown. And a quick promo plug, I run a museum in Smethwick, just outside Birmingham. I'm a museum manager.
Right.
And I've written history books.
Museum of what, by the way? Is it the Museum of Interesting Reptiles or, you know, or what's what?
Or, you know. It's a social history. We have no reptiles.
We have no reptiles. No poultry.
It's a social history museum in Smethwick.
Okay.
And there's bound to be somebody listening to you from Smethwick, in which case I'd say get in touch. They're everywhere, people from Smethwick. And anyway, so I spoke to Stephen Lamb and said, look, I want to do this book. And he very bravely and kindly said, okay, go for it. Let's see what you've got. And so I wrote it all through the lockdown period, a few thousand words here and there. And it turned out very well. And the first print run just went straight away. It was really... And the reviews have been extremely kind, which is nice.
Always good, always good. The only problem is you never remember a good review, you always remember the bad ones. But anyway, but again, that goes back to my original point, is that if you have a rock band and you get a following to begin with, they will stick with you through thick and thin. And they will buy the, you know, if you've written intelligently, you're not trying to rip off, you know, the Alice Cooper, then they'll be interested in it.
I think the point here was that much as I could have gone on easily for several thousand more words in what I think of the band, and some people might find that interesting, and I think they probably would, I kind of knew that having the band members and some of the solo career musicians' input as well meant that it was very likely to go well. And the other thing is being in a book and not on the net is still quite a good thing to do.
Yeah.
People still like to hold things to look at them. And I said to these guys, you know, what you're telling me isn't going to go on the net unless someone's actually going to sit down and type it out and copy it.
Yeah.
Which nobody has yet, I think.
Right. Of course, you get to the end of the 70s and you know, Alice Cooper, the band, the original incarnation sort of drops off, gets fired, sort of, it all sort of closes down, doesn't it? I mean, some of them were more surprised than others to be sort of let go or go on new directions. I mean, it could have been very much the end, or, you know, we could have seen him doing that, or, you know, he could be, Alice Cooper, the person, could be now just doing that sort of 70s nostalgia tour, but he didn't, they didn't, and the band sort of reinvents itself.
Yeah, that's right. I think, personal opinion, I always think the backup plan was, if Alice's solo career hadn't taken off, he always had the thing of going back to the band. But because he did take off with the Welcome to My Nightmare album, it was not likely he was going to go back at all. I think they retained their friendships. It must have been a bit difficult for a while, one would think. But they now all seem to get on very well. In fact, the surviving three other members, Michael, Dennis, Neil, are on his latest album, Detroit Story. So that continues on.
And so what do you hope that people will take from Alice Cooper in the 70s?
Well, if you go and see him live now, then 2/3 to 3/4 of the set list are likely to be from that era in the 70s covered in this book. That's the area, I think I've said, where he was just such one of the big guys in that era who defined what it is, the 1970s, and what was possible. In terms of the book, I hope that anybody who gets a copy of the book finds out something they don't know. And makes them want to go and listen to the music again. The trouble is, people don't listen to albums now, I don't think, really, Charles. I think they listen to songs, and these were created as albums.
But I was talking to a friend of mine who runs an independent record store down in Teddington, afternoon to you, Rob, and he was saying, because it was National Independent Record Day, or World Independent Record Day, last Saturday, and he was saying the great thing is that people are now getting back into vinyl, because an album, as opposed to going to a theatre and seeing a series of sketches, it's seeing a play. An album, especially around that time, is something in its entirety. And I've talked to loads of people who have written about music or perform music and said that very tactile thing of going to a record store, waiting for an album to come out, because it would be preluded in the music papers, pre-internet, remember, for weeks, you know, so-and-so is coming out, you know, Jam new single. You would rush down there opening again. You would get the aforementioned, you know, vinyl. You would rush back at speed, at pace, and to put it on, and then just opening up, and we were talking about the smell, that the new vinyl smell, and then you pop the record on, and you know, the stylus goes, and they get that groove, and you're off.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things I would add to that if we have the time. The one is the Cooper Group were way ahead of the rest of the pack, way ahead with the packaging. They had Ernie Schifalu's company, who I spoke to for the book, Pacific Iron Air, if you're familiar with this, the school desk that opens out. Actual stand-up school desk for schools out, the wallet sleeve, the $1 billion babies. And the packaging was just, you could immerse yourself in that packaging at great length. The Coopers really did great work on that. And then the other thing you've going on about vinyl there, side two, track one. Do you remember how important side two, track one was?
Well, it certainly
You're
was.
You're turning the record over.
Yeah.
And then side two, track one is the one that sells you on it. And for example, $1 billion babies, no more Mr. Nice Guy, side two, track one, you know. These things are just so important in life, I think. Yeah.
I'm just thinking back to the singles, because on the single, the B-side, as important. So Bohemian Rhapsody, Freddie Mercury, great sounds of that. Yeah, B-side, I'm in love with my car, Roger Taylor. Gets the same.
Well, I like that song. I do like I'm in Love with My Car, but I think, did you know that he would have got equal publishing royalties? I think that was the reason he wanted it on the B-side.
Exactly.
He knew that.
Exactly. That's the thing. That was the reason. But yeah, it's a very different experience to, getting an album to just going and downloading immediately the whole list and the whole thing, which I think a lot of people are sort of rebelling against now or just getting fed up of now because the novelty has kind of worn off.
Yeah, it has worn off. It is great if you listen to an album all the way through. And there's a sequencing of the album as well, isn't there? The flow. And the Cooper Group always sequence their albums almost like a concert, a mini concert. And Alice continued that in his solo career. The order was important and it worked.
And I mean, I'm just because he's a bona fide sort of sober and golf playing person now. He's got what mm-hmm. did he? I mean, I know I've got my timelines mixed up here, but was it towards the end of the 70s or was it in the 80s when he got himself straightened out? Oh, I'm just trying to think.
There's been a few cases of straightening out,
right.
I'd say. The first straightening out came at the end of the 70s, and he's covered in the book. I kind of didn't cover it in great detail because I wanted the book to be a celebration of positives, and I didn't want anyone. I didn't speak to him for the book, by the way, in case the listeners are wondering. I did ask. I got close.
Yeah.
But the view was it would mean it was officially sanctioned.
Right.
Okay. If he spoke. So he didn't.
But you spoke to, I mean, pretty much everybody around him. And presumably now that you've done the one and this, you know, Alice Cooper in the 70s, and that begs the question we have part two, at least. The 80s was quite interesting too for him. And you know, the new audience to discover him, you know, that maybe the man himself will stir himself off the back nine and come and talk to you.
It would be nice, but I think it's a problem with the management. It's the same. I'm working on a book at the moment. The next one out for me is Black Sabbath in the 70s.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Now
I'm doing that right now. Now, none of the band will speak.
Yeah.
And that's their prerogative, absolutely fine. But other people, such as Mike Butcher, who produced Sabotage and engineered Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, he has spoken at great length and has been very useful. And some other people have. You have to think outside the box a little bit.
Well, I'm currently reading Ozzy Osbourne's autobiography, strangely enough, actually. So he writes about it himself as well in some detail, and it's hilarious reading. And there's you know, there are loads of stories about Sabotage and Sabbath Bolt Volume 4, which got very interesting, we say, maybe a little bit a bit caffeine enhanced, we'll say, shall we?
I think that's fair to say, yes. I think, yeah, there were enhancements used in the making of those albums, yeah.
Well, anyway, let's get back to the subject in hand. This book, because I'll definitely get on to talk about Sabbath in the 70s. This book is, and you know, you're West Country, you're from Birmingham. It's you know, it's in the blood. So it's in the blood, Chris, to write about Sabbath, because, I mean, they're around the corner from you.
If you grew up in Birmingham in the time I grew up in, and I was born in 61, December 61, rock and metal was a thing to be a fan of, definitely. You went down to the Odeon or the Town Hall, and it was just literally in the blood. I loved all those bands that you've named, Zeppelin, Sabbath, and then into the prog of Yes, I suppose, and Floyd, ELP, that sort of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but the West Country as well, all that coming out, and like the Zepp and the whole thing, and you know, I mean, Lemmy's from Madeley, which is just in north of Stoke-on-Trent. So, I mean, it was that, you know, and all the other bands down there, there was a great rich seam. There was a great rich seam of rock coming out of the West Midlands, the Black Country.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Sabbath always claimed it was the hard environment of Aston in Birmingham they grew up in, but I never saw that hard environment. It just seemed like a normal place to live to me in Birmingham. But
maybe
we did get Judas Priest, Sabbath. Yeah, so yeah, we have had those bands too. But we also got UB40. So
yeah, not bad at all. I worked with them in my time. I'm just thinking now that's we can now say Chris Sutton grew up, you know, thinking Aston was quite nice actually. Whilst Ozzy Osbourne thinks it's a complete hellhole. So Chris Sutton harder than Ozzy should be on the t-shirt.
Possibly. No, I don't mean to disagree. No. It just seemed that's just seemed to be how it was to me. Birmingham was an industrial city, and apparently it was worse than I thought it was.
Well, there you go. Anyway, we'll talk about the Black Sabbath book, because that's going to be a riot, I can tell. This book is called Alice Cooper in the 70s. It's out now. Is it published by Sonic Bond Publishing? Yeah.
Sonny Bond Publishing, very kind people, and very kind Mr. Stephen Lamb for letting me do the book. Wonderful man.
And if people want to find out more about you or about the book is available as a virtual download from our TRE bookstore. But where can they, do you do the web thing? Where can they find you?
Me, I'm in lots of places. I'm Smethwick Heritage Centre, the museum, which we published once before. I'm there. Sonic Bond, you can get hold of me via Sonic Bond. If people get send an email to Sonic Bond, I'll talk to anyone, definitely.
Well, this one is called Alice Cooper in the 70s. It's by Chris Sutton. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you. I hope we can do it again soon sometime.
Oh, I think the Black Sabbath book is already booked in. Don't worry about that. Chris Sutton, Good. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for your time. Take care, everyone.